Action Council, and wanted to do a PowerPoint presentation because I wanted to bring along some photos of kind of what's happening on the ground. And basically, I'm just here to give you a little bit of overview for what we're doing in the Crooked River watershed and the importance of state support and of OEB and just what it takes in order to perform restoration on the ground in Central Oregon. So I'll just go ahead and give you a few details about our watershed.
I'd just first like to say thank you both for coming. It's always good for us in the legislature to hear directly from you folks on the ground the successes you're having and how it's working for us.
Well, thanks for having us. It's good to come and share success stories, so thanks. The council's mission statement is really important to how we go about doing the work that we do. We're working to promote stewardship of the Crooked River watershed and its resources to ensure the sustainable watershed health, functions, and uses for optimal conservation and economic benefits. And the key words for our council there are sustainable and economic. In our watershed, restoration isn't successful if it doesn't address the importance of the economy of our watershed in Elk Creek County. So it's a real important thing as the council goes about its business to balance those two things, and it really dictates how we approach restoration. A little bit about our watershed. It's almost 3 million acres, which essentially would stretch from about Woodburn to Eugene and from well into the Cascade foothills to the crest of the Coast Range. It's a very large watershed. Portions of seven counties, although almost entirely in Crook County, almost 10,000 miles of streams. The caveat to all of this is that it has it's very sparsely populated, so it's not in that sense like the Willamette Valley. We have several large landowners who own vast portions of the watershed, so it does make our challenge a little less intimidating. The council was funded in 1997. It was initially kind of formed back in 1991 when a group of ranchers got together and felt that they needed to create an organization that would be a voice for them and would help facilitate restoration in the watershed. So it truly began with landowners who felt that a watershed council would benefit them. The membership includes 12 stakeholder groups. That includes landowners, representatives from state and federal agencies, local irrigation districts. It's a real broad-based kind of group. And in those 5 years that we've been operating, we've worked with over 100 landowners and administered just under $1 million in grant funds. A large portion of those have been through OEB, but we've had 12 other funding sources that have provided assistance on our projects.
If I might ask a question, who sponsored your council and how are the council members appointed?
The Crook County Court sponsored our council. It was an unofficial group until the Crook County Court represented the group. Right now, I guess my exposure to council members is that if we have someone that leaves the council then addresses appointing an individual to take that position. That circumstance we're in right now, we have someone who's leaving the board of the Ocho Irrigation District. The individual who takes over that new board position will then become the new representative on the council. So in a lot of cases where it's an agency representative, it's someone who steps in to fill the role of that departing person.
And are those different stakeholders designated by the sponsoring court or council for the county commissioners? Or?
Yes. When the council was formed in 97, part of the legislation that was adopted by the council was that those 12 positions would be standing positions. And the intent there was to have representation from all of the different interests, natural resource interests in the watershed. So those were established at that time and are mandated that those 12 representatives always be from those groups.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Just a map of the watershed. You can get a sense for the extent of particularly headwater streams. There's a lot, just under 10,000 miles of streams in the watershed. You can see Redmond on the left half of the screen there. There's really only one incorporated town or city in the watershed, and that's Prineville. The rest is unincorporated. And Bend is just off the bottom left of this screen. This is kind of a great overview shot of the lower Crooked River, and it really gets right to what some of the issues are in our watershed, and that is the balance between the resource itself and the human use of the watershed. You can see here that there extensive agricultural use right up to the banks of the Crooked River here. And then on many of the smaller tributaries in the watershed, it's the same way. And so this is really the balance that we're always faced with, is restoration versus the economic productivity of the land. The Crooked River watershed has a diverse kind of array of habitats and of landscape. This is on the North Fork of the Crooked River, a deeply incised canyon with ponderosa pine, something that most people don't really vision when they think about Central Oregon. A lot of high mountain meadows with extremely old stands of ponderosa. These are the real critical areas in the watershed. They're the headwaters of the Crooked River. So when we talk about kind of what our restoration challenges are, there are really three main ones. I call them the ION challenges: channelization, vegetation, and irrigation. Channelization was a product of the 1964 flood and the belief that moving water through a system faster would be beneficial to a stream. So a lot of the stream miles within the watershed have been straightened so that now that they're dead straight and no longer have a natural meander to them. So the streams aren't able to dissipate energy, accelerates erosion, not good habitat. So that's something that we're fighting a lot, kind of putting those systems back to the way that they were. Vegetation is really the key to our watershed. When we don't have riparian vegetation, there's nothing to hold the stream bank in place. There's nothing to shade the stream to create good, viable habitat for fish. It's really the key to everything that we do. And then irrigation, which really comes down to stream flow. We have pretty serious stream flow issues in the Crooked River. A lot of the streams, the vast majority, particularly the lowland streams, are dry at this moment. It's a product of 3 years of a drought cycle, but also many of the streams in the watershed are over-allocated in terms of water resources. So while the irrigation is important to the economic sustainability of the watershed, it's something that needs to be addressed as we go about talking about restoration. We want to make sure that there is some water in the streams. Just a quick photo of channelization. This is an example of a creek, Mackay Creek, just outside of Prineville, that has been straightened, and now we just get accelerated velocities through here, which do a lot of damage when we have flood events. Vegetation, this is a great example of what happens in the Crooked River watershed when we don't have any willows or alder or riparian vegetation on the stream bank. There's essentially nothing there to hold the soil in, and the flow regime there is such that we have a lot of high water flash flood events. So this is a real concern, getting vegetation back in these areas. And then irrigation, this is kind of a great shot because you can see the wheel line irrigating the pastures in the back and then kind of the dry stream in the foreground. And it is a trade-off that we need to balance every day. So the top three restoration projects that the council are engaged in, bank stabilization, channel reconstruction, and habitat enhancement. The first two are really larger scale measures to try to get streams back to a more natural condition. The third is in those areas where things are looking really good, sometimes we'll go in there and make create some better habitat for fish in those areas. Here's a shot of it's a very small scale thing, but this is what we do when we talk about bank stabilization. One of our most common projects is to put down juniper trees along the stream bank, and what happens is the soil falls in behind the juniper, then creates a stable base for vegetation to come back, and the juniper then blocks the stream energy from hitting the bank. It's a very simple, inexpensive fix, but it's been highly successful, and it kind of proves that a very low-intensity, hands-off approach can do a lot for a stream if you just kind of let it do what it wants to do. This is an example of what we're doing when we're talking about channel reconstruction and dealing with channelization. That previous photo of the stream, kind of straight as an arrow, this is just downstream of that. One of the projects was to go in and create a more natural meander pattern through here. And this is a bit raw because it was taken right after the project was implemented, but since then willows have come back to the site. And this creates much better habitat and is a much more natural stream function, this type of stream system. And this is an example of habitat enhancement. As you can see, there's already mature riparian vegetation there. What we did was to go in, put some root rods and some logs in the stream to create some pools, better habitat for fish. Our top three restoration obstacles in our watershed: limited funding, is an obstacle for us. We do not have an adverse fish in our watershed, and that kind of cuts us out from a lot of funding sources. We're hoping that in the coming years we will have an adverse fish in the watershed if passage occurs at the Pelton Round Butte complex. Right now our species of concern is red-band trout, and so that kind of limits our number of funding sources. Another obstacle for our council is our capacity. I'm the only full-time paid staff of the council. We have a part-time hydrologist that works for the council. But right now we're turning away landowner projects because we just don't have the capacity to deal with all the projects that are coming through the door. I guess it's a good problem to have, but we're looking to be able to fund additional staff members to address all the restoration that landowners want to do. And the third obstacle is economic realities of landowners. A lot of these individuals are living kind of on a year-to-year basis trying to produce an income, just a living income off the land that they own. And so taking a few acres out of production here and there can be a real blow to their bottom line. So while they may want to do restoration, they can't always do it given their economic situation. Three things that have been really easy for us, and I don't want to say that acquiring OWEB funds is easy, but the availability of those funds. Having OWEB funds available to the council obviously has gotten us to where we are today. We're attempting to diversify our funding sources so that we can rely on other areas and not be so centralized on one source, but having those funds there has done an amazing amount for our watershed. Win-win projects are easy. Projects where landowners benefit and the resource benefits. Those are slam dunk projects. They're easy to do, easy for landowners to deal with. Those are projects where they're able to maybe get some water back, get the water table back up so that they're no longer irrigating areas, but we're also restoring the stream at the same time. And that leads kind of right to the third thing that's easy, which is generating landowner interest. When you're doing win-win projects that are a win for the landowner and a win for the resource, the projects sell themselves. And so we aren't out there beating the bushes trying to create projects. They're coming to us. Three things that the state can do for us: continued support for OWEB or other sources of funding for this type of restoration work. And that kind of falls into two categories: projects and coordinator support. There is an adequate amount of funding out there, or at least at this time, for projects. We've been really successful with securing grants from OWEB to do projects. The other realm of funding that OWEB provides is coordinator support. And I guess one of the things that I want to emphasize about that pool of funds is that the support that goes into financing my position creates a lot of projects that leverage OWEB dollars. Right now we're leveraging at about a 3-to-1 basis on OWEB dollars on all of our projects. So then that's through either other funding sources or in-kind donations from other organizations. So by funding a coordinator in a watershed, it does more than just fund a position. It funds the leveraging of other restoration efforts. And when we do projects, we're hiring local contractors, we're utilizing individuals from other state agencies, so it's an important economic function as well. Continued support for ODF&W. A lot of our projects deal with improving fish habitat, and having a local fisheries biologist at our district office is really important for us to continue to consult with that individual and make sure we're doing what we need to do. And the last thing that the state can do for us is simply do what you're doing today, which is keep your ear to the ground. Keep asking individuals like myself and Patricia to come in and talk about the work that's being done, just to keep appraised of what's going on out there and understanding what our challenges are. This slide may be a bit misplaced within my presentation, but I want to give you a sense for how we address restoration in the Crooked River. One of our major problems is in the upper left there. We have low stream flows. So one of the things that we want to do in order to stabilize stream banks and get water back in there, get some root capacity to hold that water, is increase vegetation. Well, what that does is it slows the stream down, which allows it to deposit sediment, brings the water table up. When you increase the water table, it increases sub-irrigation, which means the water that's flowing out underground, feeding the meadows and pastures that these landowners use, which means they can decrease the amount of irrigation they need to put on their fields, which then increases stream flow. And the reason I threw this in here is just kind of, as we all know, everything's connected. Simple things such as increasing vegetation lead right to increasing stream flow, which makes better habitat, more fish, and the benefit to the landowner is that their land is more productive. So this really does all go together, and it really is a win-win situation. This is an example of the kind of work that the council's been involved with. The time frame on these two pictures is greater than the council's tenure. It's about 10 years, but you can see what simply getting vegetation back on the stream can do. In the upper left-hand corner there, we have a creek that had a unstable bank on the left there, no vegetation, and in about 10 years what we've seen is a vast increase in the vegetation in the riparian area. We've got, those are beaver dams in there, water holding in there all year round, whereas in the upper left-hand corner, water was gone by August or late July. So this is an example of what restoration dollars are doing in the Crooked River watershed. And that's pretty much it for my presentation. I want to thank you again for letting me come in and talk to you, and let me know if you have any questions.
Thank you, Jason. Does the committee have any questions? Senator Byer.
Your last picture, which creek was that?
That was Mill Creek, okay. Which is really kind of our model sub-watershed in the Crooked River. We've seen a lot of restoration work, a lot of it by ODF&W before the council was started, and then council has picked up since then. We have almost full riparian exposure on Mill Creek, which means that there's nearly no livestock grazing in the riparian area on the entire stretch of the creek, which is doing a lot to get that vegetation back in there.
Any other questions, committee? Jason, how much staff do you have in your council?
We have myself and a part-time hydrologist. And the hydrologist actually is a really unique position that I want to take a minute to tell you about. That position was kind of initiated by the council's need to secure its own technical assistance. We were designing so many projects, and we were relying on other agencies for that design work, that we wanted to be able to provide it on our own. And so through kind of a unique partnership between the Watershed Council and the Ocho National Forest, we secured a grant through OEB to fund one-third of that individual's time. The forest then provides the other two-thirds of that time. It's a great leverage on OEB dollars, and what it does is one-third of the time he spends his time working on designing our project, the other two-thirds he works for the forest. It's been a great partnership. It's opened up other doors between the council and the forest, and it's really, I think, improved some of the perceptions of the Forest Service and other federal agencies. When they can see this individual out working on their land, they get a different perception of what federal agencies can provide. So that's kind of our staffing situation, myself and then a one-third time hydrologist.
So you don't have any receptionist or financial staff or monitoring staff? Or?
No, we have our fiscal agent is the Crook County Soil and Water Conservation District, so they take care of our annual audit. They have our tax ID number, but essentially we do, I guess me, takes care of bookkeeping and those things.
I have to probably should put this on the record that Ken Burley was answering for you back there, shaking his head. Okay, well, thank you very much. Appreciate your coming.
Thank you.
Treasurer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairs and the committee. Would you like to hear about the Conservation District and then what else we're doing? I talk and it's my choice.
It's your talk.
I have 5 minutes from floor here. The Deschutes Soil Water Conservation District that I'm still the chair of are focusing on three issues too. Primarily introducing people with small acreages that we have lots of them these days in Deschutes County to proper conservation measures. We're working on a huge irrigation water management relative to saving water from the several districts. There's actually five flumes that come out of the Deschutes right there around Bend. And then we've become progressively more famous this year for our goat weed effort. It's been on, I noticed on public radio and several of the Portland stations lately because the goats have been in Portland eating weeds, and it's been sort of a fun thing in that as we've worked on many projects, what we discover is that going back to the basics is always the answer to doing things well, and so we've been sort of working on that old keep it simple, silly philosophy, and trying to just do individual work for people that have land conservation and water conservation problems. We have one staff and a water quality tech position. We have a district manager who does the many, many things, and then the one person that's putting together various projects around Deschutes County at this point. And she works with everyone. We're doing things on a big scale. Several big subdivision resort type folks are working with us on doing stream bank work where they're along the Deschutes. And we're also doing many, many, many of these 2 to 5 acre horse farm and llama farm kind of operations. And so it's keeping Jan very, very busy. We, again, just have an answering machine to take messages, and are dreaming someday of having a full-time staff person that would sit there and coordinate our efforts, but that hasn't happened yet. Another thing that we've been doing in the Deschutes is that we have taken a very active role along with the YEAST RC&D and the Deschutes Basin Resource Conservancy on a basin-wide planning process. Last December, we had a gathering called the State of the Deschutes at Kaneda, and it pulled together people, all sorts of water users, all sorts of resource users from across the county, and of course the Forest Service and ODF&W and all the land managers that are there. And out of that came a vision that it was time for us to just really take responsibility of our very diverse situations, and then the pressure coming to us from the population increases relative to Bend still growing and the resorts still developing all around Sun River and clear up into the Redmond area. And so we started meeting and talking sub-basin planning, and Jason has been involved in that and has all the other councils and districts and counties and cities of the entire basin. The Deschutes Basin Resource Conservancy has taken the lead role, and the YEAST RC&D is doing the sort of the fiscal and on the ground management sort of piece of this. And we have met monthly in something we've called the Deschutes Coordinating Steering Group. And early in the year, we decided that we really needed to have a relationship with each other if we were going to be able to do this huge vision of ridgetop to ridgetop planning, and do that planning so that we could invest OEB dollars, other grant dollars that we could secure, and any dollars that flow through the various Senate Bill 1010 water quality groups that are working in the basin. And so the MOU that I handed you earlier is the result of many drafts and iterations of us trying to come together and see what we could agree to collectively to move forward with this project. With the cities involved, and especially Bend, with its moving toward 75,000 people, water becomes a huge issue, and one of those things that with the groundwater study and our long-term effort there and with the various irrigation districts, we really felt it was a good model to look at ourselves hydraulically and begin to move through that process. So to begin that and have it really be effective, it needed the people to commit. And so we decided that out of the list you'll see on that document, out of that list, we needed to have at least 16 entities signed to begin functioning as this determining body in the basin. And we got that relatively quickly. We've been meeting with the Power Planning Council, who have, at least to this point, committed to funding their level of study, which is the stream and riparian area efforts, to gather all the information and put it in a usable document is the effort so far as around the stream is concerned. We have, although not really signed contracts, we've retained someone to do that writing for us. Our contract hasn't been signed with Bonneville and the Power Planning Council, so that actually hasn't started, and yet we're all out pulling things together. And I actually attended yesterday a power planning training effort around the EDT, the diversity, biological diversity effort that one, or program that a consulting firm has developed to bring all these things in and help determine areas of need in stream. So we are waiting for the final dollars around that and to do a kickoff, because the other huge commitment we've made to ourselves is that we're going to develop relationships so that our basin, the human element in our basin, understands the effort around this planning process, understands that we're doing sort of a seamless planning process, starting with the uplands and the Forest Service, moving down through the private lands, and ultimately working in the streams. First, to pull together all of the information that's out there, because there's a great deal of wisdom between the various fish entities and the Forest Service and the BLM and the district and the watershed councils. We know a lot more about our basin than we ever have at a given point in time. The Deschutes Resource Conservancy is helping fund some of these things, and as they do, a number of the projects. One of the things that started out as sort of a part of our basin-wide planning and moved forward a little faster than some of it was an idea to put together a carbon sequestration effort as a pilot. And so we have actually signed agreements. The Deschutes Resource Conservancy and the YEAST RC&D working as a partnership with the Oregon Climate Trust. And we have dollars and have hired a riparian planter and are moving forward with an effort to put up to a quarter of a mile stream buffers. That's, again, by the landowner's choice, but up to a quarter of a mile buffers that we will, one, plant for them, or plan for them, plant for them. They will receive compensation. They sign a 50-year contract for some compensation for the development of this. They can also sign up and get Natural Resources Conservation Service dollars that would come through the various environmental quality and various kinds of programs. And this, along with the CREP effort, trying to put enough money in one place to make it reasonable for these people to pull pieces of land out of production from their current uses and let them move into something more sustainable, but also with an effort to gain some carbon and hold some carbon in larger woody growth over this longer cycle of time.
Excuse me, Patricia, I want to go back just really briefly. Did I hear you say that part of the funding is going to come from CREP for this long-term compensation? But where are you getting the rest of the funding to pay these people on a long-term basis?
There is some money actually coming through the contract that we've signed with the Climate Trust that will go to the landowners. And so we're trying to stack two or three things. I guess I'm still dreaming of the vision of maybe someday even be able to have taxes abated or some sort of tax relief around these parcels. I think that the thing that we find in Central Oregon, and Jason alluded to it earlier, is if we can compensate people or at least bring them to level so they're getting back as many dollars as they would be making either pasturing or farming that riparian area, that's a huge element in bringing people into doing conservation and having it last long-term. And I think it's probably since the last time you saw me at this chair, it's that long-term picture, I guess, that I've certainly personally been focusing on. We have dollars that we've been spending, and now what we are looking for is out there into the future, a real change in how the whole hydrology of the system works. Anyway, that's sort of a rough overview of the last 9 or 10 months, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Questions about the MOU, I can do a couple of comments around that. We did all this, and of course, all the way through the process of the sub-basin planning, the Warm Springs Tribal Government has been working with us, and we all took our document, our copy of this homeland, to have our individual bodies sign it, and after the attorneys for the tribe looked at it, they said, well, they weren't going to sign it right now because most of us weren't big enough sovereigns for them to deal with. Obviously, that's somewhat in jest, but they're hoping to maybe develop some sort of relationship with the state at that sort of level rather than with us, and yet they're in totally committed. And putting this in writing, I find, has been a very valuable piece of the process. We've tried to pull decision makers around the table, and then those decision makers actually signing an agreement to do something together makes it even a little more powerful. And it is really nice because with all the councils and the districts and the providers of technical assistance from the other agencies there, we really are coming up with a very open, frank discussion about the magnitude and also the opportunities of the effort. And if you have any things that I missed that you might ask, go ahead.
Just the real beauty and power of this planning effort is that it's truly oriented from the ground up. One of the things that the council was encouraged at in becoming involved with this process was that it was driven right from the bottom, that this was a planning effort that would encompass everyone and that would reach down to those low levels and really tap the energy and the interest at those levels. So my council has a real measure of faith in this planning effort that it can really achieve something great because it is coming from that level and working upward. So we continue to support this effort and look forward to it succeeding.
And obviously the dollars that do most of this are from OWEB, some amount from the various ODA grant programs. Hopefully we'll be able to have more back in the Deschutes Resource Conservancy, which delivers us some very specific dollars. But we're going to go out and continue to try and think of new things like the Climate Trust and other ways to make this sustaining. And so that's...
It helps to have the Power Planning Council in the back door, too, doesn't it?
It has been an interesting study. We've set two event times when we would kick off our story to the public in general, and each time the contract's not been signed. So what we've done now is we've moved that out to January so we don't sort of get these expectations too high. But having the Power Planning Council make that level of commitment helps bring in, it's like the OWEB dollars you seed into everything else. That first effort then starts to be able to gather like the snowball a little bigger all the time. And it seems reasonable, and being the continual optimist, I even think someday that somebody from National Marine Fisheries might contribute something.
We can always be hopeful. Well, thank you, Patricia. Any questions from the committee? Well, thank you both very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay. Last item on our agenda is the presentation dealing with the West Nile virus. I guess we have two of our presenters here. I'd like to invite Monty Turner and Dr. Clark to come forward, and Ken Berry, I guess you're part of this too. And if one of you will bring up an extra chair, we have a Dr. DeBess, who is going to be coming here shortly, and I'd like to have the whole panel at the table at the same time if we could. I might, just as a little bit of an introductory, we put this on the agenda simply because it is in the news. It is a concern to the state of Oregon, and we felt that it's appropriate to get the whole issue in front of the legislative committee and quite frankly, try to define whether we have conflicting policies within the state of Oregon and make sure we're all on the same page and moving in the same direction. So, Mr. Turner, if you'd like to begin, please do so.
Thank you, Chairs Messerly and Jensen. Monty Turner, Division of State Lands. The role that Division of State Lands thinks that we can play is to convene a group of communicators from mostly state and some of the federal agencies that will be dealing with this issue over the coming months in an effort to try to coordinate that side of this issue. As you know, there's a lot of public interest and particularly a lot of landowner interest about this issue. So we felt that one of the things that we could do would be to try to coordinate information related to that to prevent duplication and to try to keep everybody abreast of the latest information. A lot already exists from other states that have been dealing with this issue before it's hit the West Coast, so we'll first research what some of those states have done and then see what needs to be adapted, use experts in Oregon to adapt and update that information. We'll target that information primarily for landowners who may have wetlands, ponds, rivers, and streams on their property, and will have questions about how that may relate to mosquito breeding and spread of the disease, and then also to staff members for natural resource agencies that are also going to be getting a lot of questions and needing information to answer those questions. The group that we pulled together has not yet met. We're scheduling a time for next week for the first meeting. We have about 10 agencies that have indicated an interest in participating, and we'd be happy to keep you abreast of the work from that group in whatever form you want us to do.
So, Mr. Turner, is Division of State Lands kind of the lead agency on this, or are you just a participant, or who's coordinating this?
Senator Messerly, we'll sort of see how that shakes out. I'm just the convener at this point, so if by default I stay in that role, that's fine. If there are other agencies that seem to be more appropriate to take the lead role in the communication side, that's fine too.
And I appreciate that very much. What we're trying to decide here is what is the risk, not only to our agriculture community, but to the public health? And are all the agencies complementing the issue, I guess? With that, Dr. Clark, if you'd like to maybe bring us up to speed on what impact this has in your realm as state veterinarian, that would be very interesting.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. For the record, my name is Andrew Clark. I'm the state veterinarian at the Oregon Department of Agriculture. West Nile virus is a virus that is primarily hosted in birds and transmitted by mosquitoes. The mammalian hosts are incidental and dead end, the two primary being humans and horses. there are several other species which have been proven to be infected with West Nile virus, but they are very, very scarce and few. For example, there has been one dog in the United States since the virus first was identified in September of 1999. There has been one sheep. There have been two Rocky Mountain goats, a few squirrels, chipmunks, and very incidental hosts. So the only species with which we are seriously concerned is horses. In the equine family, when an animal is infected and showing symptoms, it is a very serious disease. As of about a week ago, there have been 7,462 cases in equine, and the fatality rate is between 30% and 40%. So about 2,500 horses have died of this disease in this year alone. The equine community takes that very seriously. It's a serious epizootic. Fortunately, a vaccine has been developed by Fort Dodge Laboratories for horses, but only for horses. There are no other vaccines available labeled for any other species. The efficacy data on this vaccine has just been published very recently. After a 12-month vaccination period and challenge with virus, the efficacy rate is 95%, which is very good for any vaccine. So we're fortunate to have that tool to use. I approved the vaccine in October of last year, and since that time, there have been about 11,500 doses sold into Oregon. I required that the manufacturer report monthly sales so that we know where the vaccine is going, what veterinary practices are purchasing and using it. It can be sold only to licensed veterinarians, and we have a good handle on where it's being used in the state. Part of that being because it's a conditionally licensed vaccine, which means it is safe, pure, and has a reasonable expectation of efficacy. I suspect that within a few months it will be fully licensed. Again, I would anticipate also that in the last month there has been a sharply increased interest in protecting horses, and I have published recommendations that that be done. It's the only tool we have aside from mosquito control. As a problem for agriculture, in light of the fact that horses are the only affected species in any significant number, and there is a highly efficacious vaccine available for horses, I don't think that translates into a significant problem for agriculture. It does not involve our production species, sheep, cattle, hogs, and the typical livestock production species that are important economic elements of the agricultural community. And horses can be protected and are being protected by the vaccine. It devolves then to control of mosquitoes because we can't control the wild birds that are the natural host for the virus from which the mosquitoes get the virus to then infect other, infect horses or humans. I think we, subject to direction from our from Mr. Craig, our deputy director, I would be happy to be involved in the committee that's being suggested for communications, because the equine community is very much involved in this particular issue, but the rest of agriculture is not significantly impacted.
Doctor, first of all, I appreciate your coming in on short notice. I apologize for that. But I think it is valuable that we get input from all sectors here. Do you have any knowledge of how this disease or this virus is transmitted to humans? Is it strictly through the mosquitoes, or is there any connection with the horse population?
I think Dr. DeBess will present to you the ecology of the virus and so on, Mr. Chairman, but the short answer is that it is a purely mosquito-transmitted disease. There is not transmission human to human. There is not transmission horse to horse. Well, there's not transmission mammal to mammal, I should say. It is strictly a bird mosquito and then mosquito to mammalian dead-end hosts.
Any other questions from the committee? Dr. Clark?
Yes. It's it would not be from horse to mosquito to horse.
Mr. Co-Chair, that is correct. Horses do not develop enough viremia, the concentration of virus in the blood, for the mosquito to pick it up again.
Senator Byers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If the way it affects birds, wouldn't the chicken industry or the poultry industry be affected in the state?
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Byers, poultry, chickens are not a highly affected host. They can be, and they are sometimes used as sentinel. But the biosecurity typically surrounding the poultry industry in commercial terms pretty much precludes significant involvement. And the other factor is that only a very small percentage of affected animals show any symptoms or become sufficiently viremic to cause a problem. In my understanding, it is not on the East Coast, where there are much larger concentrations of poultry, it has not been a significant problem.
Along those lines, Dr. Clark, how about pheasants or pigeons or turkeys that run within our agricultural communities?
Mr. Co-Chair, the same applies. They seldom become symptomatic.
Any other questions?
Yes. What about ancient wild? The pheasants are going to be in perhaps some wild. But wild turkeys, upland birds.
Mr. Co-Chair, my understanding of the ecology in those sort of birds is that they can become affected, but it is not a problem for them. The last statistic I heard is that more than 128 species of birds have been identified as carrying the virus, but the primary group of birds that for whom it is a lethal problem are the corvid family birds, crows, jays, magpies, that particular group, which in Oregon could be a significant factor because we have corvid birds in every ecosystem of this state. In the urban and suburban areas, scrub jays and crows are quite common. In the rural areas, crows, ravens. In the eastern side of the state, magpies, for which it is almost 100% lethal. And in our forests, ravens and speller jays and Clark's nutcrackers are all in the corvid family. So we have the potential of that family of birds everywhere in the state. And when the disease becomes enzootic, and I use when advisedly because it has been found in Washington now, I think it is a given that it will be here next year. But we do have the reservoirs throughout the state.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much. Ken?
I'm here primarily for comic relief, I believe. I see that the question is about whether there's wisdom to allow wetland restoration to continue when you're facing epidemic disease such as this that's transmitted by mosquitoes. And playing with numbers is a conceit that some people get to do. I put together a graph of the incidence statistics of human incidence of West Nile infections and deaths with the statistics for the same states on wetland losses. And in the term that there are liars, dam liars, and statisticians, you could conclude from this that the greater the wetland losses there are, the higher the likelihood of incidence of infection of West Nile virus. I don't think that means anything, to be very candid, but what I think it leads us to is we really don't know the relationship between wetland extent, wetland type, and West Nile virus incidence in humans. And I think that the issue is very clear that it is an epidemiological problem, that the carriers, the hosts of this organism, is moving across the country. And as doctor said previously, it was just recently found in I believe a raven or crow in Washington. It will be here soon. It's moving across the country in a wave that started in the East Coast in 99 So I think that it will be here regardless of what we do. I did look at some of the Center for Disease Control and Prevention literature on management, and they talk about managements that are standard management practices for controlling mosquitoes. When they talk about marsh management, they talk about removing dikes to allow freer inundation and hydrologic connection. They talk about improving hydrologic connection between the marsh and estuary, et cetera, as providing mosquito control benefits. Standing water is the preferred habitat of many mosquitoes. I know very little about the specific organism here and its ecology. I think that that's an important issue because there are thousands of varieties or species of mosquitoes. I think there is, a public policy issue here that needs to be considered, and that is we don't have, at least I don't believe that we have, good surveillance techniques in this state to indicate whether or not there are mosquitoes that harbor this disease or birds that are affected by this disease. I don't think that we have any systematic program in the state of Oregon to monitor the condition. You know, the only mosquito monitoring that I'm aware of is occurring out here in East Salem, where they're monitoring mosquitoes basically for abundance by an association with a water treatment facility that the city of Salem has developed. And they've got a magic device that captures mosquitoes by emitting carbon dioxide. And they're monitoring the abundance of mosquitoes to see if, in fact, the wetland treatment system is increasing the abundance of mosquitoes. I don't think anybody's looking at those mosquitoes to determine if, one, they're the species that carries the virus, or two, that organism does have the virus. And I'm not aware of anyone in the state who is doing that. So I think that there are some issues. Oregon will be affected by West Nile virus in one way or another. We have, as the doctor said, we have the birds that are the host of the species. We do have mosquitoes in Oregon, and so the virus will get to Oregon one way or another, primarily by birds, and then transmitted to humans and perhaps to horses by mosquitoes.
Well, thank you, Ken. You know, I think you're right. It's not a serious situation at this point, but I think potentially it could, particularly as to where we site wetlands, if there is a potential for mosquitoes. And I know from my experience in Coquille, where I lived for 34 years, and they have the log farms right adjacent to the city, it is a major problem in the summertime many times. So I think it is appropriate that we address the issue and start the discussion and first of all, assure ourselves that if there is or if there is not an issue, that we should be concerned about it.
And I think that we have, by our change in funding of local governments, mosquito control districts basically disappeared from the state of Oregon. And there used to be quite a few of them. There are almost none of them anymore because there's little revenue to support them, and that might be something that is a policy issue to look at, because rather than investing in DEET and wearing long sleeve shirts, mosquito control is an important issue.
So I assume this is Dr. Bass, and your timing is perfect. Before we move to Dr. Bess, is there any questions from the committee to Ken Bailey?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Dr. Clark.
May I mention, in terms of surveillance, Dr. Bess may deal with this, but he received some money in a federal grant which then assisted in the setting up of diagnostic capabilities at the Veterinary Diagnostic Lab at the College of Veterinary Medicine at OSU. Birds are being submitted through several channels which have been set up. Dr. Bess, you may deal with this. How many animals have been monitored so far, but I think probably around 40 or 50, haven't they? The reports come to both Dr. Bess and myself. So there is an active and ongoing program that is not large, but is set up so that it is being monitored. Thank you.
Dr. Bess, we appreciate your coming today, and we're just trying to get this legislative committee up to speed a little bit as to what the issue is, and should we be concerned, and is there anything we should be looking at? I'd like to hear the point of view. I'm sure glad we've got some techie people around here to make these things work. I'd be totally lost.
My name is Emilio Tevez. I'm the state public health veterinarian, and I'm here to talk to you a little bit about West Nile encephalitis. So to give you a background on the information, West Nile encephalitis is an emerging illness caused by a virus. Causes inflammation of the brain or encephalitis, and it's transmitted by mosquitoes and carried by birds.
Excuse me, doctor. Let me check. Patricia, are you picking him up okay tonight? You might speak again, doctor, just so we can hear it.
Oh, okay. Go back.
So, I just want to make sure we're getting you recorded, so.
It is good. Okay.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Sure. West Nile encephalitis showed up in the United States in 1999 in New York, as most of you know, and since then it's been moving west throughout the United States up to this year, in which it's moved east of the Rockies. Some of the pathways that made up created the problem with West Nile encephalitis in the United States are certainly related to human transported animals, legal or illegal. As most of you may know, there's about over 150,000 birds and other animals that come through the ports of the United States into the U.S. from other countries such as Africa, Asia, South America. And that might have been a source of the, or the way it actually came into the United States. Obviously, the human transported mosquito vectors, that's a possibility in terms of a mosquito getting into a plane and then coming into the U.S. Storms, that's the first thing that we talked about. Initially, we thought that a storm had gone through Africa into the Atlantic coast and then through a mosquito or a bird into the U.S. Infected human hosts, that's the least likely of the problems, since humans are at what we call a dead-end host, meaning you get the infection but you're not able to pass it on to any other individual, mosquito or bird. And then people have talked about bioterrorism. Initially in 1999, it was considered to be a bioterrorist attack or some sort of bioterrorist test into the United States. The virus is, as we talked before, it's transmitted through mosquitoes, and you have to have a bird that would actually harbor the infection, a mosquito that will pick it up and then pass it on to other humans or horses or any other animals that may be infected with it. Some of the mosquitoes are, the names are pretty long and difficult to pronounce, but Culex dorsalis and Culex pipiens are fairly prevalent in the United States and in Oregon, as we have seen it throughout the vector control districts and the collection of mosquitoes throughout the state. Species that are affected are usually birds, horses, mules, donkeys, humans, and some other mammals, such as squirrels have been noted. And in the last year, we've had a report of one dog and one cat. West Nile encephalitis in humans causes, it's usually perhaps over 90% asymptomatic, meaning you get the infection, you really have no idea that you've been infected with it, and life goes on as nothing had ever happened. 10% of the individuals develop a fever, influenza-like illness, where high fevers, the main symptoms are high fevers, headaches, vomiting, and diarrhea. And about 20% of the individuals develop a rash and swollen lymph nodes. And obviously less than 1% develop what we call aseptic meningitis, meaning we're not able to find out what the organism is, but it's an inflammation of the meninges and the brain itself. And 1% so far have been fatal in the United States. Up to date, up in October 4th, the numbers are about the same, but the numbers keep on changing basically every day. 2,700 human cases, 146 people have died so far. That's about 5% of those that have been extremely ill. And up to now, 43 states have been affected either by humans or animals with West Nile encephalitis. In the United States, as you can see, this illness has, from 1999, when it was found in New York, has moved across the U.S. up to this year, in which we found that Washington, in a city bordering the state of Idaho, found a positive raven for West Nile encephalitis. And in California, a human patient was diagnosed with West Nile encephalitis. That California case happens to be an unknown at this point. There's no mosquito who's positive, there's no birds that are positive, so nobody really knows how this woman became infected with West Nile encephalitis. California at this point remains free of West Nile encephalitis in terms of mosquitoes and or birds. And so is the rest of the West Coast, except for Washington State bordering Idaho. The disease or West Nile encephalitis is spread by migrating birds, which play a significant role in spreading the disease. Mosquitoes become infected by feeding on the infected birds. Remember that you have to have a bird and you have to have the mosquito along with it. If you have a positive bird and whether or not it is, that's not allowed for the mosquito population to be active, nothing is going to happen. So the mosquito has to be an essential part to transmit it to horses and or humans. In terms of dead bird surveillance, we have talked about what we're doing at OSU. That's the process of discussing what we've been doing at OSU. We got money from the CDC to provide assistance with testing for West Nile encephalitis. What they're doing is they're providing us with a service to test dead birds that are found throughout the United States. We have involved the county health departments, vector control districts, Department of Ag, Fish and Wildlife, Audubon Society. Everybody seems to be interested in providing us with the information, collecting birds, and sending those on to Oregon State University for testing. A lot of these were testing crows, magpies, and jays at this point, and a lot of it has to do with the limited permit that we have through Fish and Wildlife. Raptors have also been a source of the problem in the United States, and we're actively talking to different centers that manage and see raptors and try to do some sort of a study by which we can determine how effective these animals are. Over 120 different species throughout the United States have been known to carry the illness and be affected by it. And obviously, the migratory birds, the ones that are coming from different areas in the United States, go south for the winter and then come back up and may spread the disease into the western states. In terms of surveillance for mammals, horses are really one of the more significant animals that have been affected with West Nile encephalitis, and Dr. Clarkson has handled that. Up to about 40% of the birds, of the horses, show significant illness and die from the disease. Therefore, a vaccine has been created for horses, and we are at this point recommending that people that have horses vaccinate their animals to prevent a huge number of cases. In terms of mosquito control, the idea behind it is to eliminate the breeding grounds, standing water that a lot of people seem to have outside of their homes. And this is going to become a fairly significant issue as mosquito pools are detected positive for West Nile encephalitis, since mosquitoes do use water as a breeding ground. What's being done in Oregon in terms of surveillance is we're testing birds, we're testing animals or horses that have neurological disease, we're testing humans. Funding has been given to the Oregon State Public Health Laboratory, and that would be to test mosquito pools, chickens, sentinel chickens throughout the state, and human samples. And all this testing is being done this year up to about 2,000 mosquito pools and over 1,000 blood samples from chickens to determine if the infection is present in Oregon. We've been also talking to veterinary personnel out in the field in regards to West Nile encephalitis. We got a number of calls from them, and to basically everybody be aware of what's going on, educating the public and the physicians, nurses, and veterinarians about West Nile encephalitis, including public health individuals. And that being come through. But those are the areas where the mosquito or vector control districts are found in the state of Oregon. Can you see the map in your handout? I'm not sure what happened. But these local jurisdictions, these vector control districts are the ones that are locally funded, and they're responsible for protecting the public in those areas from the overwhelming number of mosquitoes in that population, in that area. This most, there it is, perfect. Had a little bit more to it than I remembered. As you can see, some of the vector control districts are found primarily in the more populated areas, such as Winona, Jackson County, some in the southern area of the state, and then a few other ones throughout the rest of the state of Oregon. Not every county has a district, therefore we're quite concerned about what may happen when West Nile encephalitis gets here and mosquito populations are found positive for the disease. West Nile planning is being undertaken by our office at this point, the Office of Disease Prevention and Epidemiology and DHS, to invite basically everybody that is interested or concerned about West Nile encephalitis, such as Department of Ag, Vector Control Agency, Fish and Wildlife, Forestry, Audubon Society, County Health Departments, to inform and educate people about West Nile encephalitis, let them know what we're doing in regards to surveillance, which is a huge aspect of this particular illness, and try to come to an understanding as to what are we going to do when it gets here. The purpose of this meeting is to talk about the surveillance issues, as I said before, education, general public education, public health, public agency vector controls, and how are they going to manage mosquito populations, and determine if some areas may be interested in developing a vector control or mosquito control in their area to help them through this particular disease that's coming. And then this is your test. This is a man at risk for West Ham encephalitis, and hopefully the answer is no. Thank you.
Thank you, Doctor. Just to expand a little bit on your information, should we in Oregon be concerned about some of our wetlands, particularly if they're adjacent to population centers? And should we be thinking about if we should be doing anything there?
I believe we do. We need to be concerned about the wetlands as being a source of mosquitoes in certain areas, and trying to develop a strategy by which we can diminish the number of mosquitoes in those areas by using larvicides rather than adulticides may be a way to handle the problem.
Representative Jensen.
I assume the wild horse herds in east and southeastern Oregon would be at some risk then.
Especially if they're not vaccinated for that.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And with that, colleagues, I believe that completes our agenda, and I will adjourn for the day.